I always associate the idea of a cowboy with rugged individualism. Brash, risk-taking, straight-shooting, terse. These are not only traits, but values which I recognize and have some empathy for as an American. It is no secret that my country of birth often has a unilateral, shoot-first, ask-questions-later mentality, arguably based on cinematic heroes like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. For better or for worse, the cowboy has and continues to define many aspects of American life and policy. So when I saw Jessica Orek's documentary about Arctic cowboys in Finnish Lapland, I was surprised by the grace, gentleness, humility, and humanity which she managed to capture on film. By offering a portrait of a family of reindeer herders, we see a fuller picture of what a cowboy is and what a cowboy could be. It is a life as much about nature as it is about community, as much about death and killing as it is about being sensitive to your environment and the beings that live there. It is a striking and sometimes paradoxical existence, one which was a privilege to see and discuss with the film's maker herself.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls. Casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
Jessica Orek. The name of the film is Otsinki, the story of Arctic cowboys. The film is a year in the life of a family of reindeer herders living above the Arctic Circle in Finnish Lapland.
So you very specifically title it Arctic Cowboys. That immediately draws parallels to the American West, Hollywoodification of the Westerns and things. Why was that an important parallel for you to draw between that kind of rugged impression of what a cowboy is and what is actually happening in Finnish Lapland?
Because that's what I was looking for. I grew up watching Hollywood Westerns, and I wanted to find a contemporary equivalent of a Randolph Scott character or a Gary Cooper character. And I met Arne, and Arne is literally about half of Gary Cooper's height. I mean, he's not at all the same type of figure, but he does really embody a lot of the qualities that the characters of Hollywood Westerns sort of embodied. This extreme masculinity, very capable, very rugged, quiet but thoughtful, and a certain level of willingness to sacrifice everything for the people that they love, which is an unusual quality. And Arne has that. It was pretty amazing to get to find that in somebody.
It's a really beautiful film, and it's a really sympathetic film. And it was very interesting watching it because, like, there's a lot of contrasts inherent in both the lives of these people and in the landscape and the way they work. And I'm wondering, because you lived with them for about a year, was it?
It was about 9 months out of 13. So I would go and then stay for a month and then come back to New York for a week or two and then go for 6 weeks and come back to New York and travel and do other things.
How weird was it to go from Finnish Lapland, where you're basically, you know, taking tourists around or chasing reindeer, to the Big Apple?
It was extreme. Not going to Lapland, that was that. To get into that groove was much easier. I lived in this cabin with no heat and no hot water. So the first thing you do when you get there is light a fire in the big stove, light a fire in the sauna so that you can heat up your water to shower. And that sort of sets the mood very quickly that this is what you've gotten yourself into. And there was no internet access and I didn't have a cell phone. And that was amazing and wonderful and very easy for me to deal with. The problem was going back to New York and getting on the subway and just feeling... it was too extreme. I don't know. I had a very hard time coming back to New York after being in Lapland.
The culture shock was
insane. That must have been. It must have been so weird to just get off the plane at JFK and then have to take that drive into New York. How did you choose the family to focus on? Because this is a part of a community of kind of...
It's a cooperative of reindeer herders. So it's about 30 families that manage this herd together.
And so how did you choose the family? At what point did you decide that this is the person that embodies sort of that cowboy spirit that I'm looking for?
It was actually pretty easy. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking. Originally, I was looking in Siberia, and then my parents moved to Helsinki. So I decided I was going to look in Finland. And I looked for about 3 weeks, and I just, you know, as choosing any subject can be, you know, there are a lot of criteria that I was looking for specifically with the lead, and none of the reindeer herders that I met fit that. Either they weren't right on camera, or we didn't connect personally, or they just didn't represent what I wanted them to. And so I called my mom very frustrated. In perfect mom fashion, she says, "But there's this really nice guy down at the farmer's market who sells reindeer meat. I'm sure he knows someone." So I rolled my eyes and I got in touch with the guy at the farmer's market. And sure enough, he was like, "I have the perfect family for you. Meet me in Lapland in 2 weeks." So I met him in this parking lot in Rovaniemi. And we drove 2 hours, got in somebody else's car who didn't speak any English, drove another hour, got on a snowmobile, drove another hour, ended up at this cabin with no running water and no electricity. We light a fire, we sit around, we make coffee, and we hear a snowmobile pull up. And immediately, as soon as Arne came into the room, just his presence alone, I was like, oh, I think this could maybe work. He ignored the camera, which was something that was really important to me. They just immediately, he was so careful. We fell off a cliff on his snowmobile, and it wasn't really a cliff. It was a small, terrifying moment, but it was a small moment all the same. He just looked after me immediately, even though he was putting my life in danger. It was still, you know, my safety was his first priority. That was an interesting thing to experience. And we tracked a wolverine, so immediately I could tell that he knew exactly. You know, he had the connections that I wanted. He had that sort of sixth sense of the natural world that I was looking for. And he proved it over and over again, being able to tell me what the weather would be like in 2 hours, telling me when the northern lights were going to come out, being able to find the herd in a snowstorm. I mean, just immediately he represented all these things that I was looking for and was able to prove that he had a connection to nature that was sort of mind-blowing to me, because it was something I'd never seen before.
One of the things that I noticed about the film was you're not present in it. He's not speaking to you, and the family's not speaking to you or to the camera. And there's this scene where I think he's just making a cup of tea, maybe at night in a cabin, and the northern lights are going off. And you're filming the northern lights, and he's just sort of sitting there with a cup of tea or coffee, I guess, you know, just ignoring it totally. One of the most, you know, the thing, something I'm totally desperate to see. How did you keep yourself out in such an intimate setting where you're camping with him, just on his own, sometimes with his family, but on his own? How do you keep yourself out, or do you just choose the edit where he's solitary?
There were a lot of decisions I made to specifically remove myself from the film, but also make it clear that I was an outsider. So to me, I obviously didn't want to be in the film. I don't really think that's appropriate for the most part. But I did want it to be clear that there was somebody else there, and that that person was an outsider. So, you know, of course, I was editing for the moments when he was alone and the moments where he was most in tune with what I was looking for, and in tune with himself and in tune with nature. But then I was also making decisions that the camera was always attached to me. And I mean, I couldn't use a tripod anyway because there was nowhere to put it on the back of the snowmobile. But to me, it was that I wanted them to always know where I was and where the camera was and where it was pointed, and that they could choose what they wanted to show me and what they didn't want to show me. So the sound was also always attached to the camera. I never mic'd any of them because I really wanted it to be clear that they got to choose what I saw and what I heard. I think by doing that, it gave them a level of trust that there was never anything tricky about what I was trying to do. It was always just very clear and upfront. I don't know, I think because of that, and because I just spent so much time with them, they became very comfortable around the camera. And so it was very easy to find moments where they were really just in their own worlds.
You didn't feel like you needed to be like, "Hey man, the northern lights are going off over there."
No, I mean, he was the one that told me. He was like, "Oh, the Ravenduli." You know, so I was like, "Oh, I'm going out." And he was like, "Okay." You know, they appreciate them for certain, but they see them relatively often. So
I know, and then I think that's what that moment showed me, which that was something that is incredibly startling to me. And I guess maybe the entire film in a way calls that out, which is something that's incredibly startling as an outsider to them is just every day. I mean, I'm thinking of the scene where the reindeer are penned in, mm-hmm. and then the children are trying to catch the reindeer and giving them to the parents to tag, but they're little kids mm-hmm. grabbing these animals, like, they're almost as big as they are, and yeah. hefting them up and bringing them out. I just thought, whoa, that's crazy. But they thought nothing of it, right?
It was interesting, actually. One of the things about this film was that almost the entire time that I was there, I was confused because they couldn't explain to me what they were doing or why they were doing it. Because they had all done it since birth, there was nobody had ever explained it to them, and they had never been asked to explain it to anybody else because it was just a part of their lives. And so when I would try and get them to explain why they were doing something or how they knew where they should be or how they knew where the herd was going to turn, they couldn't explain it to me because it just was such an innate part of who they were. And you see that with the kids. You see that they're just watching their parents and they're just learning it and doing it. And it's just, you know, history repeating itself in a really beautiful way.
Watching them make a fire and put the teapot, they had a very specific way. And you chose to show that quite a few times, I think, throughout the film. Why was that?
There were several things about that. The way that they make kindling and their black pot coffee that they do. To me, the moment anybody stops for more than 10 minutes, somebody makes a fire, somebody gets water, somebody makes coffee, always. The moment you stop, it was an action that always happened. And for me, it was a really comforting ritual because I knew that when we stopped, I was going to get warm and I was going to get food, which were things that I constantly didn't know when would be the next time to do that because nobody was going to wait for me. So if I was, you know, if I didn't have food, I was just going to go hungry because I wouldn't be allowed to stop and, you know, pick something up at the pizza joint. Like it was, you know, I had to carry everything with me. That rhythm was really important to me. But on top of that, the way that they do those things, the way that they shave that kindling and the way that they make this grounds in coffee is to me sort of those gestures are the accumulation of generations of reindeer herders that have done it that way. You know, they make the coffee and they drink it with the grounds and the grounds are in the coffee and you're just chewing on your coffee. And that's not the way they make it at home. It's just the way that they make it when they're out in the woods. For Christmas one year, I gave them little to-go mugs with French presses in them so that they could heat up their water and have normal coffee that you're not chewing on. They never used them. You know, to them, that grounds in coffee is part of reindeer herding. That's part of when you're in the mountains and you're watching the herd, you're making grounds in coffee, and that's the way it is. The history that is built into those motions was really part of who they were and an important part of how they'd come to be and what I was interested in representing.
It's amazing because just in the beginning of the film, you know, there's this very ritualistic way of stripping the animal, skinning the animal, taking its organs out, salting the meat, these kind of things. But then you contrast that relatively quickly with the slaughterhouse, the more corporate side of it. And I guess that maybe, that's one of the themes of the films, is that invasion of that private life or that ritualistic, traditional way of living with the land versus
the mechanizations of modernization. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely, that the encroachment of modern technology is helpful and hurtful all at once. And it's an incredibly complex problem, and which is why we built something called the Otsinki Season, which is an online interactive that accompanies the film that's part video story, part interactive debate that addresses a lot of the challenges that they face as contemporary independent farmers. And they're the same challenges that are faced by contemporary independent farmers the world over. So that was really important to us that we did that. But it was also important to me that it didn't change the film and the atmosphere that the film creates. But to go back a little bit, that ritualistic is that is what it is. I mean, to me, those motions that they've repeated so many times and the way that they make coffee and the way that they make kindling, that becomes sort of the chorus of the song that is the movie. I mean, it becomes this poem that you get to go back to, the sort of the same stanza that's repeated over and over again. And that was an important part of building the film and just sort of celebrating those little ritualistic, but also just incredibly pleasingly well accomplished moments.
Watching him cut a stick, like a bit where he's cutting the stick to put the pot on. And I just thought, man, he's confident with that knife.
Yeah. That knife is an extension of his arm.
Oh,
yeah.
I am such a wuss.
It's so satisfying to watch.
I mean, there's not much dialogue in the film, but the bits that are there are really good. Like, that knife has lost its edge very quickly, and this is good fish.
This is good firewood. So simple. There are conversations, but
I salted it. I think that was my favorite part. She's like, the wife says, the fish is good. And he goes, I salted it.
Yep. So finished their whole conversation during that dinner scene when they're picnicking by themselves. That, you know, this is a good spot. Good firewood. The fish is good. You know, just.
I think it speaks to, again, I mean, going back to this character that you've gotten together with, I mean, there's this roughness, and you chose deliberately to start that film with a bit of roughness, and at times I thought a kind of brutality, as elegant as it was portrayed. You know, watching an animal get cut up is pretty intense. It's pretty intense. I watched it all. I didn't look away.
Good for you.
But it hurt a little bit. But then there's this sensitivity of the family together with their kids and taking care of each other. And it's really interesting to watch. And then also then you start to see that sensitivity with the animals themselves as well. They're quick, but they're not brutal. They're not mean. Yeah, there's death in these animals. Some of these animals are going to a slaughterhouse, but it doesn't feel like it's out of malice.
That's a very nice summary in that I put that slaughter scene at the beginning because there was no way of getting around it. That's what the reindeer are raised for. They use the reindeer, they eat the meat, they use the reindeer hides, they use the antlers and the nails, they use all parts of them. You know, they eat the heart and they eat the tongue and they, you know, use the toenails for jewelry. And so it's a very complete part of reindeer herding. There was no way I wasn't going to include that. But to me, it was important that it happens at the beginning because it wasn't about that was the final product. The final product is their relationship with the animals. And I wanted you to come away after, you know, an hour after you've seen that slaughter, having come to see that part of it. And that's the part that you remember. But of course, everyone remembers the slaughter, unfortunately. But I just wanted to get that out of the way at the beginning. But it's interesting to me, especially with Americans, because a lot of people ask me why I included that part. And not only would it have been a lie to not include it, but I really very strongly believe that if you can't watch an animal being slaughtered, you shouldn't eat them. It's amazing to me that Americans are okay with showing our kids extreme violence done against humans, where people are having their eyeballs poked out with pencils, but we can't talk to our kids about where our food comes from. And I think there's something deeply wrong with that. And I think the only way forward is to get people to understand where it comes from. And the girls, you know, the girls were all there during the slaughter sequence, and that's just, you know, it's their reindeer. They're sad when the reindeer die, but they still know that that's where their food is coming from, and they're still, you know, they'll still learn to butcher a reindeer when they're old enough.
If you filmed for an hour, never mind a year, in a chicken coop
or a cattle ranch in the U.S. I mean, not a ranch, but, you know, one of those
abattoirs.
Yeah. It would be not only disgusting and horrible, but the way that these reindeer have a wild lifestyle, and that Arne and Lasse know every single reindeer.
I know this reindeer was one of the lines. Yeah.
One of that lines when he's like, oh, this reindeer, I know this reindeer. It ran away the autumn before last. So it must have been 2 years ago. And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember this particular reindeer. So the fact that they have this relationship with these animals, to me, is just, it makes it all that much easier to watch them be slaughtered because you know that they're respected. So that's an important part of it.
This brings in another thing, actually, because then there's this whole aspect of the tourism. And I guess, again, if people want to find out more, go visit the website, because I was looking at it and it has that great screen where it goes, what should you do with this land? Is it for forestry, reindeer herding, mining? That seemed like a bad idea. I didn't click on that. And tourism is a big aspect of it. And one of the things I noticed, which I thought you must have been very conscious of, is there's this real contrast between the noise levels. And I noticed noise a lot when, you know, there were large stretches of the film where it was very quiet, very subtle, not much is happening. We're looking at a painting, essentially. And then there's these other scenes where it's just really loud. And I had to turn I had to turn it down. And the helicopter's going, and the snowmobiles are going, and there's people shouting, you know, like, it's a much different environment. And can you explain that contrast and what it's like to be part of it?
Well, it was interesting because obviously it was a very conscious decision not to include any music in the film, because part of the surprise that I encountered when I first moved to Lapland was the silence there. There's so few insects, there's so few birds, and sometimes the shape of the landscape, there's almost no wind. And so I would spend entire days with my ears ringing because there was nothing to break up that silence except for me. And so you just, you know, you start to hear your own heartbeat, and it's a really strange experience. So that was really critical to me, that you get the sense of how quiet it is there. I mean, there's the part with Lasse where we're sitting in this cabin. We've heated up the cabin, and he's heated up coffee and burgers and stuff, and we're waiting for the snowmobile tour to get there that's led by somebody else. It was so quiet. We'd been there for hours just sitting in front of the fire because neither of the guys speak English very well. Most of the time we weren't talking. We would just sit quietly together because there wasn't much communicating to be done. And they never talk anyway. Even if they had spoken English, I think they probably wouldn't have had much to say to me. So we were just sitting there, and it was so quiet. You hear these snowmobiles approaching, and I just remember that door opening and these tourists, all these Spanish tourists spilling through, and it was just, it felt like we had been teleported to another planet. I mean, it was, the chaos was so extreme, and the noise level, it was, I don't know, it just felt deafening, even though it wasn't that loud, you know? It wasn't that people were yelling and screaming. It was just so different than that. And so that cut to me was such an important cut to make, that where he's quiet, he's alone, and then there's this moment when these tourists sort of burst into his world. Those moments where the silence is broken are deafening.
And it's weird, it's very strange watching these same characters just interact, but because they interact on their own and with nature and with animals. They interact with each other as a community and with their families, and then they have this other type of interaction, which is with the tourist industry. And it doesn't seem like they resent the tourist industry, but it doesn't feel necessarily part of their ideal way of existing. They're taking digital photographs of people, and like, I don't know, maybe I'm getting a wrong sense of the way it is, but it feels a little like maybe it's not the ideal way to be spending their time, but they kind of have to do it.
They all have second and third jobs. Reindeer herding is not sustainable as a financial lifestyle. So they all have to have other jobs. And they certainly don't mind the tourists. I think in a way they enjoy, you know, the interactions, and they enjoy that people appreciate what they do and that they get to share that with people. But it certainly isn't their natural state. I think it can be exhausting for them. I think naturally they're all introverts. And so to be on all the time for the tourists, I think can really fatigue them. So I think they like the tourism industry to a certain extent, but I do think it's a challenge.
I guess both tourism and I guess environmental change, climate change, that's got to be affecting the way that the livelihoods of these people, and how does that all interconnect?
It's incredibly complex. I mean, this is why we built the interactive, is because of one of the problems that they face is climate change. The way that snow melts dictates where the herd goes, and it dictates how much moss they have access to, whether, you know, it's freezing over and whether the reindeer can walk. You know, the snow is hard enough for them to walk, but not too hard that they can't dig through it to get to the moss underneath, and hard enough that they can run if they're chased by a predator. You know, the predator management laws that have been put in place by the EU have been hugely problematic for them. There's so many complex issues that there's no right answer. I think they think about them in a much sort of more desperate way, because it is something that they are helpless to change for the most part. I don't know. I can't imagine what it would feel like for them. I mean, I watch them struggle with it, and I appreciate how difficult it is, but I've never been in that position where everything I know is moving beyond my control and heading over this Niagara Falls of doom. You know, it's just there's no stopping it. They will probably be the last generation of reindeer herders unless something changes, at least in that area, because the way the predators are coming over the Russian border, it's, you know, they're losing a third of their herd every year. That being said, I think they also just have learned to deal with things on a day-by-day basis. I mean, one of the things that I learned from them that is incredibly difficult to remember in New York, but is something I hope to never unlearn, is just how to be more present in life and live with intention and just sort of pay attention to what's at hand. And they, you know, they do that. And I think that they're troubled, all of them, but they're also happier than most people I know.
Otsinki, everybody. The story of Arctic cowboys. Thanks to Jessica Orek and the Glasgow Film Festival, which is where we got a chance to see the film. If you want to learn more about the movie and the issues facing those living and working in Finnish Lapland, go visit arcticcowboys.com. There's some really thoughtful, interactive experiences there, as well as ways you can see the film. It'll definitely be screening in Hudson, New York from March 20th to the 29th, and at the Belfast Film Festival from the 27th of March to April 5th. We'll close the podcast today with a song by Canadian musician Jaron Freeman Fox. He's won 3 Canadian Folk Music Awards and is on tour right now in California till the 23rd of March. Go see him live if you get a chance. You can hear more music on his website, theoppositeofeverything.com, get a copy of his excellent new album, and find out more about where he's playing. This song is called Dogwood.
I wish I had wheels on my shoes. I wish that Jesus still was Lord. I do. And him and I, we would ride the rails together. And we would spread the good word, spread the good news. But they nailed Jesus to dogwood. There's no more news to be spread. The blood has all run back to water now, and only time raises the dead, or so I'm told.
Multi-